Hey, good morning. Good morning. Welcoming our online audience, Amflin, Roane County Bearden is joining us right now. And you can grab a Bible. You can turn to Matthew. We're going to be in Matthew's Gospel today in chapter 26, picking up in verse 36. We're in a series called Honest Prayers. And as we get started, if you've been around Two Rivers Church for a while, you know this is true. But if you're newish, kind of here, or maybe even new today, welcome. And here's what it is that we're talking about when we use the word prayer. Depending on what your faith tradition is, when you use that word, it can mean a couple different things. If you come out of a very formal kind of church background, it's a very formal kind of approach of going before God and making your requests. For us, what we're talking about when we use the word prayer, we're talking about having a conversational relationship with God. I said this a couple weeks ago. That's not new to us. That's from a guy named Dallas Willard from the early 80s. He talked about having a conversational relationship with God from an evangelical perspective. As believers in the Bible, that we would actually believe the Bible's true, and we can actually hear the voice of God or the Holy Spirit working in us in real time. And so this isn't some newfangled kind of thing. This is really kind of old. But when we're talking about prayer as conversation, having a conversation with God, the thing about a real conversation is it's honest. It's real. So honest prayers are about having an honest conversation with God. And when you're having an honest conversation with another person, you don't fake it. You're not lying or telling a half-truth. You come and you're honest. And that's how you know you have real depth of relationship, is you have the ability to be brutally honest with someone else. Now, in a kind, loving sort of way, right? Some of you take brutal honesty as a chance just, I'm going to unload all my crap on you. No, that's not what we're talking about. Being kind people, but being brutally honest. So that's the essence of this series. And this weekend, we have a driving question. And the driving question is, what do I do when I'm pressed and God seems silent? What do I do when life's pressure comes in, begins to press on me? I cry out to God and it seems like he's not there. I've talked before about a season in my life, and I'm not going to do it again. Like, you only have so many stories. Like, I only have so many stories. Like, my story is only so many times I can tell it. I've told this a bunch. If you're not familiar with my story, I'll give you the super brief version. In the summer of 2005, in June 2005, my father passed away in June. I lost my job in August. My wife was diagnosed with cancer in October, and I didn't really find a new job until April. There was some major stress in my world. There was a lot of pressure in my world. And during that season, God used a book by a guy by the name of Pete Gregg. He's a pastor in the UK, so he talks really cool. And in this book, he actually writes really cool too. But in this book, it's called God on Mute. It really spoke to me. And so today, what I'd like to do is we're going to read or have read, I want you to listen to a passage from that book as we begin to set up this weekend and talking about expectations that we have in relationships and expectations that we have as we live in a broken world. I want you to go ahead and listen to this.
I drove home from the most recent board meeting with my good buddy Mike, a guy who looks so much like Buzz Lightyear that he could, and in my opinion should, make a fortune at children's parties. More important, Mike is almost certainly the nicest person to exist since Jesus. I'm sure you know some nice people, but I guarantee you that Mike could out-nice them all, and he wouldn't even know that he had done it. In spite of his niceness, Mike and his wife, Jo, have not had an easy ride over the past few years. Their daughter, Lucy, was born with a profound physical disability, which means that she will never walk. In 3 years, her little body has endured 4 major operations. Mike and Joe were only beginning to come to terms with the emotional and practical challenges of this situation when the leaders of their church had a disagreement that gradually led to their community falling apart. Understandably, Mike and Joe felt sad and angry, unsure even of whom to blame. Around this time, Mike's hips began aching, and at the age of just 32, he was diagnosed with degenerative arthritis. To make matters worse, Mike is an outdoor pursuits instructor whose job involves hiking, cycling, climbing, canoeing, and sailing. What would this diagnosis mean for his career and their future? On top of all these difficulties, I knew that Mike and Joe were desperate to relocate and had been praying like crazy without success for their house to sell. How on earth do you cope with it all? I asked Mike as we drove slalom through the rain down the narrow, winding lanes of Dorset. With what? He asked. You know, the church, the house, Lucy's condition, the arthritis. Oh, that, he laughed. I'm not sure that I do cope. Yeah, but how do you make sense of it all, Mike? Where does it leave you and God? He went quiet. The wipers swept rain from the windshield. And then Mike, looking more like Buzz Lightyear than ever before, cleared his throat and said something very simple and very profound. I guess I've realized that life is fundamentally tough. I chuckled, and Mike drove on in silence. I guess, he continued, eventually speaking slowly as if he were laboriously pulling thoughts from a swamp. I guess I used to think that I had some kind of divine right to happiness. I mean, obviously, I knew there was going to be the occasional rough patch, but, well, to be honest with you, these days I find it easier to just accept that life is tough, like they did hundreds of years ago, than to feel sort of hard done, as if I'd been robbed. Why blame God for stuff that's just the reality of life on a messed up planet? Am I making any sense, Pete? I nodded. I knew exactly what he meant. Some words aren't cheap. The rain roared and hissed on the road, and the wipers kept time. Mike nodded toward the large white beak protruding over the front of our car. We've got surf canoes and painkillers and combustion engines and all kinds of good stuff, he continued. But I reckon that for most people, sooner or later, just getting out of bed in the morning becomes unbelievably difficult. And when things are sort of ticking along nicely in life, as they do sometimes, you really need to treasure those times because they're not normal. As we drove on through the rain, I thought about Mike's words and remembered a good friend in America who had just lost his job and now had no income for his four children. I thought about him, and I thought about Sammy's epilepsy. For me, there's something liberating and even cheering in Mike's morose pragmatism. Maybe life just is very hard, and that's okay. Each day, Jesus says, has enough trouble of its own. He, of all people, was realistic about how tough life can be. The Apostle Peter was equally phlegmatic when writing to the saints who, due to persecution, were scattered across Asia Minor, saying, "Do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you." Perhaps we should accept what older people and poorer people and many of those with disabilities already know. Things are probably going to be very difficult today and just as hard tomorrow too. Maybe by adjusting our expectations, we can reduce the sense of disappointment, isolation, and unfairness riding on the back of unanswered prayer. With a business-as-usual approach to life's trials, the good times can become surprising and delightful. It will be our blessings, more than our sufferings, that provoke us to ask God why.
Expectations define every relationship. Every time I meet with a couple, do premarital counseling, the first thing we talk about is expectations. And every young couple says the same thing: I don't have any. I don't have any. And then we begin to ask questions, right? I don't have any expectations. Sure you do. Who's going to take out the trash? Who's going to change the oil in the car? Are one of you going to do it? You're going to take it to a mechanic? You're going to take a quick loop page? You're going to take it to the dealership? It's probably depending upon what your parents did and what your parents did. You have expectations. And all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, I have expectations. And then they run down the list, right? I have all these expectations. The same is true in our relationship with God. We have expectations. And our expectations are really high. That life would be good and easy, and when it goes sideways, when life hits the ditch, we ask why. And I love Pete's perspective when he says, maybe we have that upside down. In a world that's broken by sin, maybe we have it upside down. Instead of going, why did this happen to me? Maybe we're going, why not me? Why wouldn't this happen to me? Why wouldn't I get that diagnosis? Why wouldn't I lose my job? Why wouldn't I have a relationship that ended up in the gutter? Why wouldn't that happen to me? We're going to look at this prayer that Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, and we're going to take a look at having an honest conversation. And what we're going to see that as followers of Jesus, the honest conversation leads to a heart resolved to follow Jesus. As we enter into the struggle, as we enter into the conversation with God and we get real with Him, as we toil in that conversation, it leads to a heart that's resolved to follow Jesus. But it's not simple, it's not easy, it's messy, but it's real. So here we go. In Matthew chapter 26, picking up in verse 36, Jesus has now come out of the walled city of Jerusalem. He's gone down into a valley. You've heard of it, the Kidron Valley, very likely if you're familiar with the Bible. Often when in like the Bible, you think, oh, valley, this big thing. It's like a little ditch outside of Jerusalem. They go down through the ditch and they approach on the other side and they head to this place called Gethsemane. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane and he said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, so could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, my Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. Both Matthew and Mark want us to know where this happened. They both state specifically, it's in this place called Gethsemane, which in Hebrew is the oil press or like the wine press of oils. It means an olive press. That's the place. It's in an olive grove. And it's the time of the year when olives aren't in season. And so it's abandoned. And Luke's gospel, he says that it was Jesus's custom. And we don't know if that means like he went there frequently when he was in Jerusalem, he would go to this place or if it was just his custom on Passover that after he ate the meal with his followers in Jerusalem that they would go to this place. We don't know what it means, but it was a familiar place. And it's important that it's a familiar place because it's how Judas knows where he's going to be. But it's a place called the press. That's not insignificant to both Matthew and Mark, they want us to know that this is the place where Jesus is feeling pressured. A couple weeks ago, we talked about the fact that Jesus experienced fear. And some of you were like, oh, what? He experienced fear? What do you mean? He's God. And absolutely, he's God. And he's also fully man. And what we see in the text is he was filled with fear. Luke's gospel talks about him sweating blood like that, like he was so stressed out that he had physical indications of major stress. And some of you are like, well, doesn't the Bible say, don't be afraid? Aren't we supposed to not be afraid? Doesn't it command us over 300 times? Do not fear. Why do you think it commands us over 300 times to do not fear? Because life is hard, and sometimes fearful things happen. As Joshua is getting ready to take over the nation of Israel and head into the promised land, God says what to him? Over and over and over again. He says the same thing. He says, take courage. Be of good courage. He says, take heart, right? Dig deep. Don't be afraid. Don't be discouraged. Don't do that. Why? Because what he was about to do was going to be really hard. We have to be reminded of what is true. Because why? Life is hard. Sometimes pressure comes. And Jesus has a brutally honest conversation with the Father. He says, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." Now, sometimes the brevity of biblical accounts, they give us a misperception. And so I want to encourage you this week that you would read this same thing from three different gospel perspectives, that you would read Matthew, Mark, and Luke's perception of this event or their description of this event. Because sometimes the brevity of this statement, all the words that we have in Scripture aren't all the words that were said in any given moment. They're the words that are recorded. And so they're the words that are important that we would know, but that doesn't mean that Jesus simply said these words explicitly. This is all he just said. "If it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." It looks very sterile, right? It looks very clean, very simple. "I don't want to do this, but if you want me to." That's how you can read that. But that is not my perception as you read all the Gospels of what happened. When Jesus says, hey, he tells his disciples, "My heart is greatly troubled. I'm sorrowful to death." And he falls on his face and cries out. Now, if I had been the editor, and when it says here, "Father, let this cup pass from me," I would have chosen an exclamation point. Because I can't imagine that it was like, "Well, whatever. It'd be nice. Please, would you do that?" No, he's crying out. And what's he crying out? He's crying out, "Not this. God, not this." And often, I think this describes what we do in prayer. We get pressed. Something's coming. Our company is downsizing, and we cry out, "Not me, not this, not now. I'm getting ready to send a kid to college. I'm in my 50s. I can't find a new job real easy. Not this, not now." Or we go the other direction. "God, please that." Fill in your "that," whatever it is. Yeah, "God, please," and then fill it in, right? Allow this to happen, right? This is kind of how we pray, "not this and please that." And here's the thing, I want you to know, that's right and okay and good. I'm not saying don't pray this way. I'm saying pray this way. Ask, keep asking, pray, "God, not this, please that." That's okay, why? Because we see Jesus pray that way. And over again in Scripture, we see this example of people crying out to God and God responds because guess what? We ask because sometimes there are other ways. We saw that a couple weeks ago with Hezekiah. King Hezekiah was told by Isaiah that hey, here's the deal. You're going to die. Get your affairs in over because this is terminal. You got a couple days. Fix your life. Get it all together. And Hezekiah does what? He cries out, "Not this." And God said what? Okay, not this, 15 years, 15 more. You get 15 more years. Sometimes when we cry out, there's a different way. And this starts to get into our view of God and it starts to mess with us because sometimes we mistakenly view God as being very linear. Like there's only one path that works. It's just one path and that's God's path and anything else is off God's path. But sometimes there's whys in the road. We come to the why in the road and we ask God, "Left or right? I have two job opportunities. Do I go work for company A or company B? What's your will?" And God says, "A or B." "But what's your will?" "Make a decision. I've given you intellect and wisdom and a heart to follow me. A or B? Which? Which do you want? You just tell me which. A or B." And all of a sudden we're like, God's not answering. God's not answering. Why is he? Why is, because guess what? God's not linear. It's not like there's one path. It's not like there's one thing. I remember we had a small group years and years and years ago. And in that, there we had a young woman, and she was praying for Mr. Right. And in her view, there was only ever going to be one Mr. Right. And I was like, that's terrifying. What if you missed Mr. Right 3 years ago and you never run into him again? Does that mean that it's all over? Yeah. No. God's not linear. That's not how he works. If love is a choice, which it is, there could be a few rights. There could be a better right. God's going to work in it, right? Like, he's going to work in the midst of where we are. And sometimes God prefers course A. And you get that diagnosis and they say it's cancer. And it's this is the road you're on. And sometimes people cry out and they say, God, not this. And God brings healing. How? Sometimes through supernatural healing. Sometimes he uses chemotherapy. Sometimes he uses radiation. God uses lots of different things, right? And people experience healing. And God says, okay, it's not this, few more years, whatever that is. But sometimes God says, no, this is the end of the road. This is the end of the story. Why does God do it that way? I don't know. But there's something significant about God's people crying out to him that moves his heart. And so it's important that we wouldn't just take the shortcut and go, whatever's going to be is going to be. That's not true. Our intercession matters. Our crying out matters. And we cry out, not this or please that. That's good. But then it leads us to this point. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. It leads to a resolve. And Jesus was resolved to the Father's plan. So Jesus was born to go to the cross. Do you think he knew that? Jesus was born to endure the wrath of God, which this cup, when he talks about the cup, this is enduring the wrath of God. He was born to endure the wrath of God on behalf of humanity. It's what he was born to do. And he comes to this point and it's hours away. And he says what? Not this. Surely, if Jesus was feeling the pressure and he was born to do something, and he labored with God in the struggle in the midst of all of it, surely, if the God-man struggled, it's okay if you do too. Surely, there's something significant that happens in the midst of crying out, in the midst of struggling, in the midst of the toil of saying, God, the pressure is too much. I don't prefer this path, but whatever it is, I'm going to walk with you. There's a resolve that Jesus has. And that's the example. As we look to Jesus' resolve to the Father's plan, it leads us as followers of Jesus today to be resolved that we would say, Jesus, I will follow you. No matter what, I know this. I know that you love me, that you're for me, that you've given me your very Holy Spirit to be in me, to lead me, to guide me, to bring affirmation and confirmation that I belong to you. And so I'm going to follow you. I don't get it, but I'm going to follow you. It reminds me, a few years ago, there was, it's not here. It was, all my stories are from long, long, long ago. And I sat in my office with a guy and his wife had just walked out the door. And he said, I don't know what happened. We've been married 30 years. She just walked out. Tell me more. Like, were you guys in the midst of conflict? Were you fighting? We've never fought. I said, what? I probably, like, they train you, like, hey, don't ever let your facial expression give away your surprise. And I had that early on, but I was like, what? You've been married for 30 years and you've never fought? I said, well, this is a problem. Healthy dialogue, healthy conflict, healthy learning to process things in a healthy way. This is important. And we got to the question. I said, okay, what's the solution? And what's the solution? What's the answer? What's the final thing that you would say, I will continue to follow Jesus? You'll know that, you know what? I will follow Jesus if, and he said, if my wife comes back. And I said, what if she doesn't? That's the question. When life's pressing, do we give God only one solution? Do we give God only one thing? We talked about a couple weeks ago that if we ask an honest question, both yes and no are viable answers. As a dad, I love when my kids come to me and they make requests. I love to say yes. Can we do that? Yeah, we can do that. Can we do this? Yeah, we can do that. But sometimes, guess what? The answer is no. No. Nope. Can't do that. Nope. That's not possible. Nope. That's not a good solution. Now, I try to say yes more than I say no, but it all depends on how many times they come to you with the same question. But there's something, right? There's something that God's not offended that Jesus comes three times. God's not offended that there would be this asking, seeking, knocking, as we see in the scriptures. In Luke 22, 44 says that being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat became like great drops of blood falling to the ground. God, not this. With greater intensity, with a greater resolve. Then what? It appears like God is silent in this passage. It appears like God's not answering. And I want to suggest to you that God is speaking, okay? God is communicating. And here's what happens next. Rise, my betrayer is at hand. There it is. God, not this. Jesus lifts his eyes, see what's going on, says to his disciples, hey, get up, it's game time. And then he says, it's happening. This is the path. This is where we're going. There's a resolve that leads him to the cross. He keeps the conversation going, continues to the cross, following God's plan for him every step of the way. And so for us, it leads to an action. And so what do? We keep praying and take the next step. Sometimes it's just about keeping the dialogue going and taking the next step. Often what happens for me is I just keep waiting and waiting and waiting. And then I start to grumble and complain. And then I say, what? God, why this? Why me? Why now? I question God's goodness, and I get frustrated, and then I do what? Then I withdraw. Like somehow me keeping seeking God is I'm punishing him somehow. I know this is crazy. I know that doesn't make any sense. I know it's foolishness, and yet I do it anyway. I find myself trying to withhold, right? I hold back, you know, super brilliant. Nope. Totally wrong. And yet, it's where I often find myself. But here's what I fail to remind myself in those moments. If I take my eyes off of that one thing, if I take my eyes off of this one thing that I keep praying and praying and praying about, and I lift my eyes and I begin to say, okay, wait, God, I know you may be feeling, I may be feeling that you're silent in this one area, but my life is filled with a lot of other stuff and a lot of other people. Let me lift my gaze. And as I begin to look at other people, all of a sudden the volume starts coming back. As I take my eyes off of this one thing and I'm like, okay, God, how can I pray for other people? What are the other areas? What I'll see is God isn't silent. He's communicating in all kinds of different ways about all kinds of different people. And other people who are being pressed in that moment. You see, the honest conversation leads us to take a step, to continue to follow him, to a resolve that says, okay, this area doesn't have an answer yet, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to follow you in the rest of my life. I'm going to follow where you're leading. The honest conversation leads to a heart resolved to follow Jesus. Sometimes, you know, Facebook's helpful. Sometimes. This past week, there's a guy I'm friends with on Facebook. I don't think that makes us friends in real life. I'm not sure. He posted this. It's cliche, but sometimes cliches are helpful. And it's from the great theologian Toby Mack. It's not really his. I think he just quoted it. It's hard to hear God's voice when you've already decided what you want him to say. If I already know the only acceptable answer, it gets real hard to pay attention to what God may be communicating in the midst of it. Now, I want to acknowledge what we've covered this weekend. It's just the surface. And some of you, you're struggling. You're struggling in the midst of God not answering, and you may have been struggling for a really long time. And I want to give you a resource. Here's the resource. It's unanswered.prayercourse.org. I just discovered this just the other day. It's not in your notes, okay? Unanswered.prayercourse.org. And the guy who wrote the book, God on Mute, Pete Gregg, has five sessions going through this prayer on what it looks like for us to struggle and toil with God in the midst of what seems to be unanswered prayer. And I want to encourage you, dig in, because it's really good material. Here's the thing. I believe this is what it actually looks like for us to live out a lifestyle of prayer. One of the things that we say is part of our mission here is to see people live out a lifestyle of prayer. And it's about what do we do when we have the right expectations with who God is and what he's up to. And so there's one more page from God on Mute that I want you to listen to as we prepare to close this weekend. I want you to listen to this.
In spite of all of the advances in technology and increased life expectancy, there is an extraordinary fragility to our generation. We collapse easily, our marriages fall apart, and we are quick to take offense. In our celebrity-obsessed world that is cosseted away from death and anesthetized against pain, we need to be reminded that it's normal to have problems, get sick, experience financial challenges, and face relational breakdown. Jesus promises us, "You will have trouble," but not many of us stick that verse on the fridge. Instead, when we encounter setbacks, we feel betrayed. We ask, "Why me?" as if such things should not beset a follower of Christ, as if we should be immune from the diseases that afflict our neighbors. One of the problems, ironically, can be prayer. In prayer, we set our hopes high and call it faith to pray for the perfect spouse, healthy children, successful careers, and serene families. We don't just wish for these things, but actually train ourselves to expect them. We fear the worst if we should ever lower our sights. Yet this is false faith. The Apostle Paul longed not just to know Christ and the power of his resurrection, but also the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings. The Christian witness and our ultimate hope is not merely a miraculous succession of miraculous escapes from all human affliction. Rather, it is the joy of a deepening relationship with the man of sorrows familiar with suffering, who loves us and lives in us. I'm not suggesting that we should pray for hard times, but rather that when such times come, we should feel a little less outrage and a lot more hope, because Jesus, who went through similar struggles, predicted that we would have them and promised to be with us in the midst of them.
Jesus is with us. I see so many people that have forgotten that. So many people who just, the world's terrible. But Jesus is with us. Jesus is with you. No matter what you are going through personally, no matter what we're going through in our communities, no matter what we're going through in the world, Jesus is with us. We are a people of hope. Why? Because Jesus is with us. And sometimes we have to make the clear, conscious choice to remind ourselves of that truth. He's with me. I don't like it, but he's with me. This is hard, but he's with me. That's a game-changing moment when we begin to live our lives with this view of life as, you know what? If life is hard today, that's normal. That's normal. Brokenness is normal in a broken world. So every time we experience that, God hasn't wronged us or betrayed us. He's with us in it. He's never promised to pull us out. Many people go to the, God, but you have good plans for me. I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you. Plans for good. This doesn't feel good, God. I know you said that. And they forget the context was, you're going to be in bondage for 70 years. Settle in, get comfortable. I have good plans for you. That's the context, right? So if you got that verse on your wall, put the context, as I suffer for the next 70 years, remind yourself, he's got good plans for you. Life is hard, but it's for a purpose. And there's something that happens in relationship as we toil, struggle. There's something happens to our faith. It gets deep roots. And we know God in a way that we never would have otherwise. So this week, there's some next steps, okay? And these are for you to do this week. We're not going to do these now. We're going to end with a response another kind of way. But to ask God to lead you through it, to ask his Holy Spirit, lead me in this. And these are for everybody, no matter whether or not you've been following Jesus for a long time or you're not even following Jesus yet. God, I believe that he'll speak to you and he'll lead you to give your life to following him. No matter where you are on that spectrum, these questions are for you. Where have I struggled because God seems silent? God, where have I struggled because you didn't seem to be answering? Or how can I be resolved to follow Jesus in the midst of uncertainty? What does that look like for me to keep praying and take the next step? Or who can I encourage that is in the midst of being pressed? How can I take my eyes off of me, put them on somebody else, and enter in by praying for that other person? Those people that Jesus was hoping, his disciples, hey, pray with me. I'm going to give those dudes a break, by the way. They had just drunk a lot of wine. It was really late at night, okay? You'd be passed out too. So all that to say, but there is something to people coming alongside, to being an encouragement, and God starts to increase the volume of his voice. And we'll be reminded, God isn't silent in general. God is just not answering me yet in a way that I would prefer in this one area of my life. In this moment, what we're going to do is we're just going to ask God to show us in a very personal kind of way. What's the thing? It may have been from years ago. It may be like today, you know exactly what it is. The thing where God has disappointed you, the thing area in your life where you're currently being pressed, that area where you feel like he's silent, and he needs to bring some thoughts to your mind to remind you about who he is. And so we want to pause here and give him a chance to do that. Two Rivers, we believe that God is communicating to us in real time in a very personal sort of way. If we don't slow down and allow him to do that, then we just gloss right by it. And so in this moment, ask God what he has for you to bring to your mind. God, we're grateful that you're a God who loves us and is for us. And in this moment, we ask that you would bring to mind those things that you want us to hear directly from you.